Chapter 74. Vicious Triangles. There is one matter on which the professional criminologist and the general public simply do not see eye to eye, the so-called eternal triangle. For the criminologist, most such cases are elementary, if not downright boring, but the general public has a voracious and apparently limitless appetite for them. And who's to say who's right? The triangle murder may be of small psychological interest, but it often contains great drama. Though it's rare for such a case to appeal equally to both public and criminologist, the murder of Agnes Tuveson achieved this unusual distinction. Her killers were described by Freud as one of the most remarkable examples of sexual perversion he had ever encountered. Captain Ivan Podier was not, in fact, a captain, nor was he, as he declared, a member of Yugoslav Army Intelligence. He was a confidence trickster and a professional lady killer, in every sense of the word. Born into a poor Serbian family in 1899, Podier started his career as a fortune teller in Belgrade, then joined and quickly deserted the French Foreign Legion. In 1926, he was cited as co-respondent in a divorce case by a high government official. He subsequently married the ex-wife, got possession of her fortune, and vanished. Up to the age of 33, Podier continued to live off seduction. He was short, plump, and losing his hair, but he also had that essential quality of the professional Casanova, the ability to make a woman feel that she was the most fascinating person in the world. He was heartless, but at least his victims escaped with their lives, until in 1931 he met Marguerite Suzanne Ferrand, a French woman with a firm mouth and a schoolmistressy face. She was a research assistant at the British Museum. As soon as their eyes met, each knew that they had found something they had been looking for all their lives. The 37-year-old Marguerite enjoyed chastising men, and Ivan enjoyed being chastised. After crouching naked at her jackbooted feet, Ivan realised that he had found his ideal sexual playmate, a woman whose fantasies were as bizarre as his own. This was another case of a catalytic relationship. If they had never met, Marguerite and Ivan might have pursued their ways harmlessly for the rest of their lives, but together they entered into a combination as deadly as fire and gunpowder. Marguerite was not shocked to find that Ivan was a confidence man who lived off women. On the contrary, the thought of causing pain to other women caused her deep pleasure. In March 1932, they were married in London, although Ivan was in fact already married to several other wives. One year later, in the lounge of a cross-channel ferry, Ivan noticed an attractive woman of about 40, Agnes Tuveson. She was well-dressed, and she looked distinctly sick. Ivan introduced himself as a captain in the Yugoslav army and advised her to get some air on the deck, where he mentioned casually that he was a millionaire and an inventor. In subsequent weeks in London, they saw a lot of one another, and Ivan spent a great deal of money on her, well over £500. But this was not a source of concern for him, because he'd persuaded Agnes to allow him to invest $5,000 of her money. Back in New York, Agnes returned to her job as an executive at the Electric Bond and Share Company, and she confided to her best friend that she was to marry a romantic Yugoslav millionaire. A week later, she received a cable from her millionaire declaring that he had a marvellous opportunity to invest another £5,000 for her and asking her to wire the money. She decided against it, for she wanted Ivan to come and get her, and that's precisely what he did. In November 1933, Podier arrived at her New York apartment with a huge bunch of flowers, and on December the 4th, they were married. Ivan explained that it was hardly worth cabling his bankers to send money from London. They would be returning to London in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, they could live on Agnes's money. Agnes agreed. On December the 20th, Agnes and Podier prepared to leave New York. But instead of sailing as arranged on the Hamburg, they returned to their apartment late that night. The next day, Podier told the Daily Help that his wife had decided to sail on ahead and that he was following her immediately. Their luggage had gone ahead on the Hamburg, all except for one huge trunk, which had been delivered to the apartment the day before. Podier escorted this trunk to the docks himself and insisted on staying with it until it was in his cabin on the Olympic. He had booked his cabin a week before, a single passage, with instructions that he must have a cabin above the waterline. No one ever saw Agnes Tuveson again. Some months later, her family began to institute inquiries. These led to the arrest of Ivan and Marguerite Poirier by the Vienna police, who were astonished to discover that their apartment was filled with instruments of torture and flogging. The police called in Sigmund Freud, the world's most famous psychoanalyst. Freud found the Poiriers fascinating. Marguerite alleged that her true personality was a tyrannical sadist named Count John, although she also had two subsidiary female personalities. Poirier, in turn, was physically controlled by a female called Ita, who was the mistress of Count John and who was having a lesbian affair with one of Marguerite's female personalities. He was also controlled by another two spirit girls who were tortured by Count John. Poirier admitted that Agnes had not sailed on the Hamburg. He told the police that she had run off with another man on the spur of the moment. Her luggage had arrived in Poirier's flat in Vienna and was still there. The New York police had no doubt whatsoever as to what had happened to Agnes. On the day he bought the trunk, Poirier had also bought 800 razor blades, explaining that they were cheaper in America. He had also bought large quantities of cold cream. Once on board the Olympic, he had spent several days in his cabin. During that time, the police believed, he had carefully shaved the flesh from Agnes's bones until she was only a skeleton. The flesh had fed the fish who follow every liner. The skeleton, greased with cold cream, had also slipped out of the porthole. There was no body, and circumstantial evidence was not strong enough to hang Ivan Poirier. Instead, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison for bigamy. And while he was serving his time, an angry fellow convict, outraged by some bizarre proposition, beat Poirier so badly that he lost his left eye and 8 of his teeth. It sounds like poetic justice until we reflect that he probably enjoyed it. He returned to Marguerite, moved to Belgrade, and presumably continued to live a multiple sex life with Count John and his harem. This is surely one of the clearest cases in all psychological literature of the catalyst effect, that is, of two people who would be harmless alone, inspiring one another to commit murder. Parallel cases, Snyder and Gray, Bywaters and Thompson, Brady and Hindley, Fernandez and Beck, have been discussed in connection with crimes of dominance. This is only one type of catalyst effect. There is another, equally familiar to criminologists, that is also fraught with explosive possibilities. In this situation, the murderer and the catalyst do not become partners in crime. The catalyst inspires the crime, but takes no part in it. This happens when the catalyst has a particularly yielding and gentle nature, inspiring a frenzy of desire and protectiveness that may explode into violence. It's illustrated perfectly in the relationship between Cesare Borgia and his sister Lucrezia. Lucrezia, with her gentle face and weak mouth, was a born victim. It was inevitable that she should become her brother's mistress. And from then on, Cesare could not bear the thought of any other man possessing her. One suitor saved his life by fleeing, another became her husband and was murdered on Cesare's orders. Borgia was, of course, a violent man in A. E. von Vogt's sense, a man who would rather commit murder than ever admit that he was in the wrong. On the other hand, Crippen, who was also driven to murder by a gentle catalyst, was basically a non-violent man. His wife, Cora, was dominant, and Crippen accepted her as the boss. His typist, Ethel Leneve, was completely undominant, gentle, yielding, faithful. Half a century after the murder, she told crime researcher Pat Pittman that she still loved Crippen. In her company, Crippen felt like a superman. The result? The murder of Mrs. Crippen and Crippen's execution in November 1910. The case of Dr. Philip Cross bears some basic resemblances to that of Crippen. A retired army doctor, 62 years of age, he lived comfortably with his wife and 6 children at Shandy Hall, near Dripsy in County Cork. His wife was 22 years his junior. They had been married for 18 years, and it had been, on the whole, a satisfactory marriage. In October 1886, Mrs. Laura Cross engaged a new governess for the children, a 20-year-old girl named Effie Skinner. Effie, like Ethel Leneve, was the catalyst type. Not particularly pretty, but with something soft and yielding about her. As soon as he saw her, the military, rather forbidding Dr. Cross felt like a hawk eyeing a sparrow. For the first time, he realised that his marriage had merely been satisfactory, never ecstatic. It had never provided him with any real outlet for his male dominance. One day, as Effie stood talking to him about the children, he bent and kissed her. He was afraid she would tell his wife or leave immediately, but she stayed. and his desire to possess her increased. His wife noticed it, and she took what seemed to her the sensible course. She sacked Effie. The girl was shattered. She went to Dublin, and when Dr. Cross visited her there, she finally gave herself to him. Possession, though, did not cool his desire. He wanted to be married to her, living in comfort in Shandy Hall. Early in May 1887, Mrs. Cross began to suffer attacks of vomiting. Her husband told her that she had a weak heart, and she died on June the 1st and was buried 3 days later. Less than 2 weeks after this, he married Effie Skinner in London. At first, he decided that they had better keep the marriage a secret and live separately, but when he got back to Dripsy, he discovered that the news had preceded him. There seemed no point in keeping Effie in London, and so he moved her to Shandy Hall. Inevitably, there was gossip, and the police finally decided to act. Laura Cross was exhumed, and the coroner found 3.2 grains of arsenic in her body, as well as strychnine. There was no trace of heart disease. The police were also able to trace the firm from which Dr. Cross had bought the arsenic, for sheep dipping. Tried at the Munster Assizes in Cork, he was found guilty on December the 18th, 1887, and hanged the following January. Effie was so shocked by the realisation that she had been the cause of the murder that she refused to see him in the condemned cell, and Cross's hair turned white overnight. Of more recent cases involving the innocent catalyst, the one with some of the most dramatic features is certainly that of Armand Roard, the mayor of Perplanche near Calais. In the early hours of May the 24th, 1967, the mayor of Escale, near Perplanche, was awakened by the sound of a motor horn. He found Armand Roard, one of the district's richest men, collapsed over the wheel of his car. Roard seemed to be in a state of shock and was taken to the Lille hospital. Back at Roard's farm, his brother, Jules, mentioned that Roard and his wife, Jacqueline, had gone off to the beach for a swim that afternoon and had not been back since. A search of the beach revealed Jacqueline's body, dressed in a pink bikini and covered in seaweed. Roard's story, when he regained consciousness, was that he and Jacqueline, who was 45, had waded into the sea up to their necks, holding hands, when a great wave had swept them away. Neither could swim. Roard had struggled ashore, lost consciousness, and wakened after dark on the empty beach. Why had a middle-aged man and woman decided to go swimming on a chilly May day? Roard was quite frank with the police. A few years before, he had had a love affair with the 14-year-old nurse of his children, Odile Vissoc, and she had borne him a child. He had sent the girl back to her parents, and ever since had been trying to make his wife forget the lapse. They had decided to go to the beach because it was on just such a day, many years earlier, that they had made love by the sea. The story sounded convincing. Certainly Roard's grief at the funeral seemed genuine, but the post-mortem demonstrated that Jacqueline Roard had not died of drowning. She had no water in her lungs. Further research into Roard's background revealed that Odile Vissoc had not been his only lapse. For many years, the rich farmer had exercised a kind of droit de seigneur on dairy maids and farm girls. But the affair with Odile had been different. She was the sweet, yielding type. It was not true that Roard had broken off with her. They had been seen lying together on a blanket long after she had returned to her parents. But recently, Odile had talked of marrying a younger man. She was a girl who needed a protector, and her status as a mistress was wearing on her nerves. There was still no reason to charge Roald with murder. And then on June the 14th, an ex-legionnaire named Jacob Kerbaye walked into the local police station with a tape recorder and played the police a conversation in which Roald had asked him to murder Jacqueline. Kerbaye, who lived in a cottage on Roald's land, said that Roald had raised the matter with him earlier. At that point, Roard's plan was to hide a needle covered with curare, the alkaloid used by pygmies on their darts, in her car seat, so that it would penetrate her skin as she sat down. She would crash and perhaps break her neck. Kerbaye didn't like or trust Roard, so when Roard called on him again, he decided to tape the conversation for his own protection. Roard noticed that the tape recorder was turning, but Kerbaye told him that it was recording music from the radio, and he played it back to prove it, switching to another track. On Kerbaye's evidence, Roard was arrested, and the police quickly uncovered the corroborative evidence they needed. On the day before her death, Jacqueline Roard had been to the hairdresser and had her hair set in a new style. The fixative would have been washed off if she had been in the sea for any length of time. The body was exhumed, and it was discovered that the fixative was still in place. Her bloodstream contained a large amount of alcohol, although normally she didn't drink, and 2 weeks after the tragedy, two bottles were washed up on the beach, one containing sleeping tablets, the other traces of ether. Roar's perfect murder plan now became clear. He had persuaded her to drink heavily to celebrate their sentimental excursion to the beach. He had anaesthetized her with ether and then carried her body into the sea to drown her. She had woken up and fought him. He had shown the police scratches on his chest, which he alleged were made by Jacqueline as she tried to cling to him. He had beaten her unconscious, dragged her ashore, and suffocated her with a car blanket or a cushion. She had then been dead when he took her back to the sea to drown her, so no water went into her lungs. Finally, the police discovered that Roar had insured his wife's life for £1 million, that's about £100,000, not long before the murder. Their case was complete, and Roar was sentenced to life imprisonment. When a love triangle is complicated by violent Latin tempers, the result is almost inevitably violence. When Dr. Joseph de Fethe was found murdered, apparently by a burglar, on December 7, 1961, the New York police sensed that this crime was less straightforward than it looked. The sobbing widow, 35-year-old Jean de Fethe, told how she had been awakened by noises coming from her husband's bedroom. She had looked in and found him dying, terribly injured. It was the violence of the murder that troubled the police. Someone had hit de Fethe with a hammer, knocking out one of his eyes, and then stabbed him again and again, covering the room with blood. This was surely no burglar, but someone who had hated de Fethe. It seemed that there might be many people who felt like that. 38-year-old de Fethe was not only a highly successful doctor, he was also an incredible lover who made no secret of his voracious sexual appetite. His temper was so violent that his wife never dared to object. On one occasion, he had been heard to boast that he had 15 mistresses. In the course of a thorough investigation of de Fethe's patients, the police interviewed two Italian youths who lived nearby. One of them had only a temporary visa. What puzzled the police was that although neither of them had regular jobs, they lived in a comfortable apartment, and one of them, 19-year-old Armando Cosentino, ran an expensive car. Eventually, investigation revealed that while the fiery Dr. de Fethe was out with other women, Armando was comforting his plump, long-suffering wife, and clearly she was the source of his income. The two youths were subjected to long interrogation. Armando, the stronger character, insisted that he knew nothing, but his friend finally broke down and told how he and Armando had gone to the doctor's house to murder him. Armando was only 19, but he was as hot-tempered and strong-willed as Dr. de Fethe, and he felt that it was time Jean was freed from her husband's domination. Cosentino was sentenced to death, later commuted to life imprisonment. Jean de Fethe, accused of being an accessory, the actual charge was manslaughter, was also sentenced to life imprisonment. Cases like these lead to a strange but inevitable conclusion. Where a love triangle is concerned, it's a mistake to speak of the psychology of the murderer. What is at issue is the group psychology of three people. And as absurd as it sounds, the ultimate responsibility for the murder lies with all three, including the victim.